He squeezed on the brakes, made a U-turn, and raced back to where the vehicle had been. He spotted an entrance to a road leading into the woods. He'd missed it because he'd kept his gaze forward as he passed by. He pulled onto the shoulder, parked the bike, then jogged over to the turnoff. The road had been blacktopped once, portions of the old surface visible here and there. Now it was mostly dirt. About 100 feet down, it veered to the right, explaining why he couldn't see the van now. He returned to the motorcycle, but before continuing his pursuit, he retrieved his mobile and texted Ananka the GPS coordinates of the turnoff. Back on the bike, he headed down the dirt road, his lights off and his speed no more than 15 miles per hour. The forest thickened the farther he went, turning the twilight into night. On and on he drove, with no sign of the van. He'd been keeping an eye out for intersecting roads and hadn't passed a single one, so he knew the vehicle had to be still in front of him somewhere. The situation finally changed after he'd been going for nearly 15 minutes. A new road led only to the left. He parked where it began and scanned it. It was almost a carbon copy of the one he'd been on. Almost. The major difference was the 15-foot-tall secured gate straddling the road, approximately 50 feet away. Attached to each side was a matching fence. There didn't appear to be any guards, but he had no doubt there were cameras. Though he was sure he was in the right place, he pulled out his flashlight and checked the intersection for tire tracks. Several showed up in the beam, the top set matching the ones he'd seen back at the highway turnoff. With the van beyond the gate, his tailing mission had come to an end, but that didn't mean Dylan had to sit on his hands until the others arrived. He rolled Ricky's motorcycle into the woods, parked it where it wouldn't be seen, and set out at an angle toward a part of the fence 50 yards away from the gate. When the wall of wire mess came into view, he knelt and studied the area beyond it via the night vision mode on his binoculars. He didn't spot any cameras, but that wasn't proof they weren't there. He changed the binocular setting again, this time to thermal. Whoa! He'd been hoping to pick up heat generated by any active cameras, but instead the whole fence lit up. The damn thing was electrified. Great. He concentrated on the trees beyond the fence. They all remained cool, so probably didn't contain any working electronics. This wasn't particularly shocking now that he had a better sense of the fence. Why waste a good camera on unnecessary surveillance when you had an electrified fence? Getting to the other side was a problem he couldn't solve on his own. He texted Ananka again, updating his GPS location. She replied immediately, telling him they were 20 minutes out. Deciding he might as well do something useful in the interim, he began walking the fence, hoping to find a weakness. Ananka, Liesl, and Harris hiked quickly back into the hills where they'd left the sedan. As they climbed the slope, they heard Dylan's voice on the comm, his words coming through in bits and pieces that most of the time made no sense. Twice Ananka heard the fragment, "Orth," and thought he was telling them to go north. Confirmation of this came soon after they began driving out of the hills, when Dylan's text arrived with GPS coordinates for where they should turn off the highway. A second set of coordinates came in as they raced north. Liesl, acting as navigator, input the info on her phone and said, "It is approximately 7 miles east of the highway." "What is it, a town?" Ananka asked. "According to the map, there is nothing there." "Switching to satellite." A pause. "There is a structure about 3/4 of a mile northeast of the coordinates." "A house?" "If it is, it is a very large one." "May I see?" Harris said from the back seat. Liesl passed the phone to her. "Do you know that area?" Ananka asked, looking at Harris in the rearview mirror. The cop shook her head. "Driven by on the highway, but never been that far out." "Are there a lot of isolated buildings like that?" "A few cabins here and there. For hunting, mostly, I think. I don't know of anything this big." Ananka glanced at Liesl. "Send Shinji the coordinates. See if he can dig up a more detailed image." Liesl took her phone back and shot off the message. A few seconds later, her phone rang. "It's Shinji." "Put him on speaker," Ananka said. Liesl accepted the call. "Hello, Shinji?" "Liesl, thank God. Are you guys all right? Do you know where Ananka is?"
"I'm right here," Ananka said. An irritated Shinji said,
"Hello. I seem to remember we talked about you answering your phone."
Ananka recalled the vibration she'd felt when they were watching the van at the barn.
"Calm down. Sometimes I am busy." "Busy? Okay, sure, I understand that, but you sent me directly to voicemail. I thought the same thing happened to you that happened to Ricky and Rosario."
"I'm fine. We think we know where Ricky and Rosario are now. Those coordinates Liesl sent? There's a building just to the north I need you to—"
"I already know about the building. That's one of the things I was trying to call you about. It used to be a resort. It was purchased decades ago by Devin Rowley's father.
Devin Rowley's father? Rowley's from this area?
He was born there, but he and his mom moved back east when his parents split. He apparently came back in the summers to visit family.
I've never heard of anyone here named Rowley other than Devin, Harris said.
Who is that?
Shinji said. Morgan Harris, Ananka said.
The cop? Are you guys under arrest, or do you have her tied up in the back?
She's helping us, Shinji. Pretend she's part of the team. A pause.
You're sure you're okay?
Shinji!
All right, you're okay. Well, she's right. I mean, you're right, Ms. Harris. Officer Harris?
Morgan, Harris said.
Morgan, nice to meet you.
Get on with it, Ananka said.
Sorry, where was I? Shinji said. Oh, right. There is no Rowley family in the Bradbury area, because Rowley isn't Devin Rowley's real name. It's Robert Seaver.
Seaver? Harris said.
Yeah, that's a name you probably know, isn't it? His dad was Michael Seaver, brother to Sharon Seaver. Seaver is her maiden name, of course. She's been married twice and is the mother of two boys.
Glancing in the rearview, Ananka saw both surprise and realization on Harris's face.
What am I missing?
Her name is Sharon Yates now, Harris said. She's married to my boss, which means she's Leo Yates and Dalton Slater's mother.
Which also means Devin Rowley is Leo Yates and Dalton Slater's cousin, Ananka said. Bingo, Shinji confirmed. And Devin now owns the old resort near those coordinates.
Ananka said nothing as the new information sank in. A clearer picture of what was going on here began to surface. We need plans and whatever other info on the resort you can get.
I found some plans that are like 50 years old, Shinji said. If there are any more recent, I haven't come across them.
Send us those, but keep looking.
Will do.
As Liesl hung up the phone, Ananka checked Harris via the mirror again.
You all right?
Harris was staring at the back of Liesl's seat. Without shifting her gaze, she said, I remember him. I was about 6, I think. Robert, I mean. Devin would have been 15 or 16. I saw him beat up this kid, a boy a few years younger than him. Chris something. I can't remember. I don't know why he beat him up, but I remember a few weeks later, finding out Chris and his family had suddenly moved away. I doubt he did anything to deserve what happened to him. Robert was this mean son of a bitch who showed up every summer. I don't remember seeing him with Yates and Slater, but I bet they were around. She shook her head. Devin Rowley is goddamned Robert Seaver. That bastard. Ananka and Liesl said nothing, letting Harris work things out in silence. After they made the turn onto the dirt road, Liesl texted Dylan, informing him they were close. It took an additional 11 minutes to reach his GPS coordinates. Dylan walked out from the pines as they pulled to a stop. Ananka rolled down her window and he leaned in.
The entrance road is right up there, he said, pointing at a turnoff a few dozen feet away. It's blocked by a big gate just a little ways in. There's a match and electrified fence to go with it. I followed it down one side, thinking I could find out where it turned, but by the time you texted me, I hadn't reached it.
Let's have a look.
If you back down the road a bit, I found a spot you should be able to squeeze the car into.
With Dylan's help, Ananka eased the sedan into the woods. Then they all worked together to create a blind of branches and loose brush to obscure the vehicle's presence. Next, they geared up, taking more specialty items since they weren't sure what they might come up against. Unlike at Green Hills Estates, Ananka gave Harris a pistol and suppressor. Once everyone was ready, Dylan led them into the forest to a point where they could see the gate.
You weren't kidding about big, Ananka said.
Even if one of them stood on another's shoulders, they wouldn't reach the top. Not that they'd want to, given the strands of razor wire. The gate appeared to have some kind of electronic lock. Maybe even an electromagnetic one. They might be able to roll it open if they could kill the power source, but that was undoubtedly on the other side. They moved west to get a better look at the fence. It hummed with the current running through it.
Did you notice any weak points? Liesl asked.
Dylan shook his head.
What you see is what you get.
Ananka walked up to the very edge of the tree line, gave the barrier a closer look, and then walked back to the others.
The way I see it, we only have a few options. One, we hike around the perimeter until we find a weak spot.
And if we don't? Harris asked.
That's the risk. What is option two? Liesl asked. We wait until someone comes out, and we recruit them to let us in.
Harris looked dubious. You really think any of those people will help us? Dylan leaned toward her and whispered loudly enough for everyone to hear, I believe you're taking the word recruit too literally. Her eyes widened. Oh, you mean... Yes, Ananka said. What if no one comes out until morning? Then we'll need to come up with a fourth option. Fourth? Did I miss the third? The third is splitting up and doing both options one and two. I vote for that, Liesl said. Three makes sense to me too, Dylan agreed. Three, Harris said. Good, Ananka said. Since Dylan had already scouted part of the fence to the west, Ananka assigned him to continue checking for weak spots in that direction. Liesl set off to the east with the same instructions. Ananka led Harris back toward the gate. So we just sit around and wait? Harris said. Unless you have a deck of cards. Or we could discuss what we're going to do when someone comes out. Do you have a plan? Of course I have a plan. 28. Justin Keller and the rest of the transfer team offloaded the participants for the midnight trials and ferried them down into the basement where Mr. Slater would finish the preparatory phase. On a cart in the holding room was the body of a man Justin had transferred to the lodge just the day before, the homeless guy. From his gunshot wounds, it looked like he'd either made a pretty good game of it or the trophy hunters had been bad shots. Likely it was both. In addition to the large shotgun blast, center chest, he had wounds in his arm, shoulder, and thigh. After Justin and the transfer team brought the last of the new prey down, Slater said, Just got an update on tonight's shipment. They're on time for 2:30 a.m. Grab some supper upstairs, then get back to the ranch, grab a little sleep, and make sure your asses are at Scholarian when the truck arrives.
Yes, sir,
Justin said. He and the others went up to the kitchen where they had a quick meal. They then returned to the van and started the 50-minute trip to Slater's farm. The road was iffy enough in daylight. Now that night had fully fallen, the drive out was slower than the drive in. Per procedure, when they stopped at the gate, everyone but Justin exited with their rifles and took defensive positions to prevent anything other than the van from passing through. When his friends were in position, Justin pushed the remote. Four floodlights mounted in trees on either side of the gate blazed on, illuminating an area of nearly 100 square feet, ensuring nothing could approach the gate without being seen. The lock disengaged, and the gate rolled to the side. After it opened all the way, Justin and the others had exactly 20 seconds to get the van and themselves to the other side before the gate slammed shut. Justin sped through the gap and stopped, still within the halo of the floods. He heard the bang of the gate shutting a few seconds before the others scrambled back into the van. Justin drove to the intersection and turned down the main dirt road that would take them back to the highway. Oh, shit! Sherwood said as someone ran onto the road at the far reaches of their headlights.
Who the hell is that?
Justin asked as he lifted his foot off the accelerator. Whoever it was, he was waving his arms over his head trying to get their attention. Justin let the van creep forward until he'd cut the distance between them in half and then stopped. The person dropped his arms and jogged toward them.
Wait, that's not a man, Justin thought as the figure neared.
It was a woman with short hair. A familiar woman.
Isn't that that lady cop from town?
Sherwood said. It was. Justin didn't know her name, but he'd seen her, mostly at night, on patrol. His hand slid down to the pistol he kept next to the seat. The cop smiled as she moved to the driver's side window and jumped onto the running board.
Man, am I glad to see you, she said.
She motioned for Justin to roll down the window.
Be ready, he whispered to Sherwood without moving his lip.
Slowly, he lowered the window.
I didn't think I was ever going to see anyone, the cop said. I was out on a hike and it got late and I got lost and somehow came out on this road. Oh, and you both might want to take your hand off your guns.
Justin's brow furrowed.
What?
If you don't, my colleague will put a bullet in your buddy's head before either of you can make a move.
She nodded across to the other side of the van. Justin and Sherwood turned. An African-American woman smiled at them through the passenger window. In her hand, a pistol pointed at Sherwood's head. She tapped the glass with the muzzle.
Let's get this window down too, hun.
Sherwood raised his hands in the air.
Appreciate the surrender, the woman said. Still need the window down.
What? Oh, sure.
He rolled the window down and put his hands back up.
Thanks. How you boys doing tonight?
What do you want?
Justin asked.
Okay, if you'd rather cut the small talk, we can get right to it. The first thing I want to know is, are your friends in the back again, or is it just you two?
No, Justin said way too quickly. It's just us.
She sighed. Justin, it is Justin, right? His eyes widened, but he said nothing. Justin, I have a bullshit meter that goes off at the slightest lie, so why don't we try that again? Are your friends in back? He licked his lips and nodded. Thanks. Now, which one of you bozos is in charge?
He is,
Sherwood said without hesitation. I appreciate the candor.
In a flash, the barrel of her gun shot through the window and connected with the side of Sherwood's head. He slumped toward Justin, unconscious.
I have a confession, the woman said. We already knew you were in charge, and unfortunately for you, we don't need your help just yet. Before Justin could figure out what she meant, pain spiked across his skull.
What's taking so long?
Frederick said under his breath after the van had been sitting still for several minutes. He and Johnson had heard faint voices from up front, but those had stopped. Due to the insulated construction of the rear compartment, they couldn't make out anything that was said.
Probably something in the road, Johnson said.
Like what?
I don't know, a tree or maybe a dead cow?
A dead cow? Have you seen any cows up this way?
Johnson shrugged.
One could have wandered up.
Fredericks rolled his eyes. Johnson was a good guy and a dedicated member of the organization, but he was far from the smartest in the group. Fredericks knocked on the wall between the back area and the cab, and then placed his hands against it and yelled,
Hey, what's the hold up?
He didn't really expect one of the guys to shout back, but he thought he'd at least get a knock. There was no response at all. He was silent for a moment.
We should check.
Aren't we supposed to stay here?
Not if there's a problem.
Fredericks grabbed his rifle and headed down the narrow aisle to the rear of the vehicle. After a brief pause, he heard Johnson follow. Fredericks pushed open the double doors. All was quiet behind the van, the road dark and empty as far as he could see. All was quiet from around front, too. That was disturbing. He'd thought they would hear Keller and Sherwood moving around. He motioned for Johnson to go right, then he moved onto the rear step near the left corner. He glanced back at Johnson. His partner was staring at him, a tremor in his lower lip. Fredericks tried to smile reassuringly, but he felt uneasy, too. He turned back to the corner and yelled,
Justin? Aaron, you guys out there?
The only response was a breeze sweeping through the trees. Fredericks cursed under his breath, looked back at Johnson, and whispered,
On three. One, two, three.
He swung around the end of the van.
Hello.
At the same moment he registered the black woman standing in front of him, he heard a scream from back in Johnson's direction. The next thing he knew, his rifle had been ripped from his hands and he was on his knees, the woman's arm wrapped around his neck. His vision began to collapse like an iris closing, and soon he saw nothing at all. Ananka dragged her target behind the van and laid him on the ground, a moment before Harris appeared with her own unconscious Slater disciple.
Any problems? Ananka asked.
Other than him screaming like a baby?
Ananka glanced at the guy at the cop's feet.
You know, technically what you just did is called assault, Officer Harris.
Smirking, Harris said,
I kinda liked it. Do you think that's bad?
You're asking the wrong person.
They loaded all four bodies into the back and strapped them into the shelves with the attached restraints. They climbed into the cab, Ananka in the driver's seat.
We need some place not too far from here where we can have a private conversation with our new friends.
Harris thought for a moment.
There's an old campground a couple miles to the north that's been closed for a few years. A few people use it now and then, but it's usually deserted.
Sounds lovely.
Ananka dropped the van into drive. 18 minutes later, Harris directed Ananka down an old winding road off the highway and into a canyon. Soon they came to a sign that read, Needham Canyon Campground, at the bottom of which was another sign proclaiming, Campground closed, no trespassing. Ananka drove past the mangled mess of a gate that had once been chained across the road and through the entire campground to make sure it was empty before choosing the spot farthest from the entrance. After she parked, she looked over at Harris.
I should probably do this alone. It could get messy.
Better if you have deniability.
I don't give a shit about deniability. These people took someone I love, and God only knows what they've done to her or the others they've taken. Would it go easier if I helped you?
Probably.
Then what are we waiting for? Harris opened her door and climbed out.
When they opened the back of the van, Ananka wasn't surprised to see the two assholes they hadn't smacked in the heads had woken up. One was glaring at the women as they moved between the shelf beds. He probably thought he looked tough and scary. The other one looked as if he was about to soil his pants, eyes wide and terrified, his whole body shaking.
"One of you is going to tell us what we need to know," Ananka said. "So, who's going to volunteer?"
Glaring boy looked like he wanted to bite her head off, so she turned her attention to the nervous Nelly.
"Don't you say a word,"
glaring boy warned. Ananka twisted back around.
"Did I give you permission to speak?"
The smartass opened his mouth to respond, but was only able to get
"foot" out before Ananka's fist connected with his jaw, rocking his head sideways.
He lolled against the pillow, groaning. "Well, that's disappointing," Ananka said. "I was really hoping that would have knocked you out." She punched him again, this time achieving the desired result. She swiveled back to the other guy. "Are you going to be a problem, too?"
No, not a problem.
"Good. How do we get past the gate?" He licked his lips and looked worried.
"You said you weren't going to be a problem."
There's a remote. It opens the gate.
"And where will I find this remote?"
Mounted under the dash, but...
"But what?"
"It's, fingerprint activated."
"Will your finger work?"
"No, just..."
"Justin's?"
He stared at her, surprised, then nodded.
"So all I need is his finger." The kid's face went white.
"Oh, God, you're not going to cut it off, are you?"
Cold water arced through the air and splashed into Keller's face. He sputtered and gasped, his head swinging back and forth until the water had all run off. He sat back and tried to move his arms, but discovered he'd been tied to a tree. His gaze fell on Ananka and Harris standing in front of him.
"Welcome back," Ananka said.
"What's going on? Why am I tied up?"
"Because I want to make sure you understand your situation before you agree to assist us."
"Fuck you, bitch. I'm not helping some nig... someone like you."
"Hey," Harris said. "Be respectful, asshole."
He glared at her.
"I'm not listening to a dyke cop either."
Ananka could sense Harris tense and wondered if she would have to restrain the woman again, but the cop held her ground. Ananka stepped over to Keller and leaned down until her face was less than a foot from his. "I don't think you fully appreciate what's going on here." She could tell he was planning to spit the moment the thought entered his mind, so she grabbed his nose and pulled his face forward. "I know you think you're tough, but you don't know tough. You, Justin, are a delivery boy. You want to know what I do for a living? I'm an assassin. I kill people a lot smarter and a lot tougher than you, all the time." She pinched harder, then twisted until she felt the cartilage crack. She then palmed his face and shoved his head into a tree, not hard enough to knock him out, but enough to leave a mark. "I ask questions, you answer truthfully, not if you understand." He took several rapid breaths, his chin resting against his chest.
"Don't make me ask again."
Without looking at her, he nodded.
"Good boy.
Where did you take the four people you picked up from Devin Rally's barn? Be specific." He looked like he was trying to come up with the courage not to answer, but it turned out he wasn't completely stupid.
"The lodge."
"The lodge? That's the big building on the other side of the gate." He nodded.
"Where in the lodge?"
"The holding room, in the basement."
She tapped him on the cheek.
"Excellent, Justin. Keep it up. Are they all still alive?"
"For the moment."
"But not for long?"
He shook his head, not in disagreement, but confirmation. "What are they going to do to them?"
"Put them in the trials."
Ananka glanced at Harris, but the cop clearly didn't know what that meant either. "And what are the trials?"
A competition."
She grabbed what she could of his short hair and yanked his face up. "Look at me." Wincing, he pried his eyes open.
"You do not want to frustrate me, and right now, dribbling out little pieces of information like you are, that's exactly what you're doing. What kind of competition?"
"Hunting. The people we took are the...
Ananka's blood turned cold.
"Spit it out."
"Prey."
Ananka didn't even try to hide her disgust. Though she might not yet know the why, she now knew what was going on here.
What about Natasha Patterson? Hera said. Did you take her to the lodge, too?
Keller looked confused, then figured out what she meant.
I didn't take her. Mr. Slater did.
When?
This morning.
Harris could barely contain her anger.
Is she already dead?
No. She goes at midnight with the others.
You bastard!
Harris yelled. If Ananka hadn't been between them, Harris would have ripped Keller apart. As it was, Ananka barely got her arms around the cop in time to keep her from clawing a chunk of his face off. She marched Harris away, the woman huffing in anger as she stared over Ananka's shoulder at Keller. Ananka said, Calm down and remember what you promised me.
Did you hear what he said? They're going to kill them.
They're planning to kill them, and if we're going to stop them, we need his assistance. Can you control yourself, or do I need to leave you behind? Harris's nostrils flared a few more times before some of the tension in her face eased.
I'm okay.
Promise me you're not going to attack him no matter what he says.
I promise I won't until you say I can.
I can live with that. Ananka slowly let her go, ready to grab Harris again if the woman made a wrong move. She didn't. Ananka returned to Keller. Officer Harris isn't particularly happy with you. As long as you continue cooperating, she's agreed not to kill you. If you don't, I won't stop her next time. Keller's gaze flicked to Harris and returned to Ananka. He nodded. The trials start at midnight?
The ones your friends will be in, I think.
You think?
I don't work the trials. I'm transportation.
So you're done for the day?
He glanced away before looking at her again.
Yeah, that's right.
She grabbed his nose again, pressing on the fracture point.
You're lying again, he screamed.
Please, let go. I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry.
The truth, she said, still hanging on.
We're heading home, but we're not done.
Then you did lie.
I lied. I'm sorry.
She let go. I forgive you. Now, tell me, what else do you have planned for tonight?
29.
Good evening, Ananka. The administrator said, Are you still making progress?
Ananka stood beside the open driver's door of the van, looking across the dark campground.
You could say that. Have you located the Patterson woman?
We have.
That's excellent news.
Not quite. We know where she is. We don't have her yet.
Perhaps you should fill me in.
I'd love to, but there's not a lot of time now. I'm calling because I need your help with something.
What can I do?
There's a truck that will be arriving at Bradbury tonight between 2 and 2:30 a.m. It'll be met south of town by at least one Scalarian security sedan and escorted to the Scalarian facility where it will drop off its cargo. I need you to arrange for the shipment to be intercepted, but not by local cops. It's got to be the FBI. You and your team were sent there to handle whatever was happening. Shouldn't you be dealing with this? Trust me, it's going to take a while to unravel everything here, and I don't think you want us hanging around that long. So the feds are going to have to be involved at some point. Might as well be now. Besides, we're going to be busy elsewhere. It's already 8 o'clock. That kind of operation may prove difficult to arrange. You don't need a whole squad of agents. A handful would be enough in a pinch. I'll text you the coordinates where the truck will rendezvous with its escort. The FBI won't act simply because they are asked to. They'll need a reason. You can't tell me you don't have a few strings you could pull. But fine. Tell them it'll be the tip of the iceberg to one of the biggest cases they've had in years. That's still not very human trafficking. Tell them it's about that. Oh, and premeditated murder on what I believe is a massive scale.
The line went silent for a few seconds.
I'll make sure they show up. Is there anything else?
Yes. When we were flying back after the last job, Ricky mentioned the bugs you implanted in him.
Purely a precautionary... I'm not questioning why you did it. What I need is real-time access to his tracking information.
Slater looked up as his daughter and Devin Rally entered the prep room. He and one of his assistants had just finished moving all 6 prey into individual wheelchairs, the 5 they'd brought over from the barn and the unused alternate from that afternoon. The trophies were all unconscious and would remain so until Slater administered adrenaline injections prior to the start of the midnight trials. Rally sauntered over and walked slowly in front of the chairs, as if he were a general inspecting his troops.
These the 2 you told me about?
He gestured at the duo who'd tried to cause problems at the barn.
Like the other prey, they were held in place by restraints, their heads drooping forward.
That's them. Raleigh frowned at the woman. Hair cascaded down both sides of her downturned face, and her small frame made her look almost like a child in the chair.
Pretty scrawny. Do you really think she'll last very long?
She'll do all right, Slater said.
If you say so. Though I'm sure I could find more interesting uses for her.
Slater swallowed his disgust. He didn't share his cousin's lust for women of inferior breeding. He thought it made Raleigh weak. But there was no sense in saying anything. It was an illness, and words were useless. Raleigh continued his inspection, stopping again in front of the last wheelchair.
This one's not so bad either. Not great, but good enough for a little spin.
He patted Natasha Patterson on the cheek as if she were a baby and glanced back at Slater.
Did I tell you I gave her a shot once? Thought she'd be an easy pickup, but she blew me off.
He squeezed her chin.
Nobody blows me off, bitch.
Slater said to his daughter,
Are we still on schedule?
Ahead, actually. Good. That meant the participants were already in their rooms resting for the midnight session. Slater's brother would be happy to hear that when he arrived.
If they'd had to adjust the start by more than an hour, he'd have to miss it, as there wouldn't be enough time for him to get back to Scholarian to oversee tonight's delivery.
Raleigh walked over to him.
A decent crop. The guy you caught today looks like he should provide a nice challenge.
I was thinking the same thing.
Well, if I'm not needed for anything else, I think I'll go take a little nap.
Dylan and Liesl met the van on the dirt road, half a mile before the turnoff for the lodge at 8:44 p.m. After she outlined her plan, Ananka obtained the specialty items Liesl had in her backpack. And then Liesl and Dylan climbed into the back of the van with three of the restrained delivery boys. Ananka drove to the intersection with the lodge road and stopped. She turned to Keller. He was kneeling in the gap between the front seats. Harris's gun jammed into his ribs.
You do anything to screw this up, you're dead. Ananka said, Do I make myself clear?
Keller winced as Harris ground the muzzle into his side.
Yes, clear,
he said. Ananka continued to stare at him.
I won't screw up, I promise,
he said. She took her foot off the brake and made the turn. When they reached the gate, Ananka said, Okay, now. Keller reached two fingers under the dash and touched the special screen on the remote. As he'd described, four floodlights switched on, turning the area surrounding the entrance into daylight. The gate began rolling to the side. Ananka drove through. When they were out of the glare of the floodlights and surrounded by trees again, Ananka stopped the van, turning back to Keller. Tell me again. The road leads to...
The east side of the lodge.
And there are no guard posts or cameras between here and there?
No.
I'm starting not to believe you again.
It's okay, Ananka said. It's not really that important. She unzipped the palm-sized leather case Liesl had given her and withdrew a preloaded syringe. Your usefulness has run its course. She stuck the needle into his arm and depressed the plunger. Within seconds, Keller's eyelids drooped and his body tilted forward, his head knocking against the dash as he lost consciousness. Ananka and Harris transferred Keller into the back, where Liesl and Dylan had already given similar injections to Keller's associates. When the van started moving again, Liesl stood on the running board beside Ananka's door, holding on through the open window while Dylan did the same next to Harris. Ananka kept their speed slow as all four searched for somewhere they could stow the van. A creek running into the woods provided their best opportunity. Ananka carefully guided the van down the slope and into the hubcap high water, then followed the stream a good 100 yards around a bend before killing the engine. In the daylight, the vehicle could probably be spotted through the trees, but at night, not a chance in hell. Ananka climbed out of the cab and joined Liesl, Dylan, and Harris on the other side. Let's go find our friends. Yates was running late. He'd been planning on getting to the lodge by 8 so he could help Slater with the final preparations, but it was nearly 9 by the time he used his remote to open the gate to the lodge. There'd been a small snafu on that evening's Scholarian security schedule. Flynn Hart, a newbie Yates had been forced to hire because the guy was some bigwig's nephew or something, had been assigned to graveyard. But it was delivery night, and the last thing Yates wanted was some goody-two-shoes accidentally seeing what he shouldn't. Yates had come up with some mandatory training bullshit to explain the last-minute reshuffling of personnel, and then had to figure out what the training would be. That's what he got for delegating. Of course, it didn't help that it was a trials week,
when his attention was always pulled in several directions. He drove onto his cousin's property and down the entrance road at a pace faster than was safe, but he'd taken the road so many times that he knew every dip and hole and turn. When he was about halfway to the lodge, he caught a flash of red lights through the trees. Apparently, another car was on the road ahead of him. He kept expecting to catch up to it, but he made it all the way to the lodge without seeing anything. It had probably been one of Slater's men out on a 4x4 doing a security check. After parking his sedan, Yates walked over to the lodge and headed around back to use the kitchen entrance. When he rounded the corner, he saw the transport van parked by the opened doors to the basement lift. Light glowed from the shaft, and he could hear the hum of the electric motor. A few seconds later, the platform reached the top, carrying his brother and Brian Evans and two warm bodies in wheelchairs. Apparently, Yates wasn't as late as he thought. "Hey, let me give you a hand," he called as he jogged over. Ananka and the others had barely set out when they heard a car drive past on the road, moving pretty fast given the conditions. It had come from the gate and was heading toward the lodge. For a moment, she wondered if its speed meant the van had been spotted driving off the road, but it seemed highly unlikely. They'd been walking by the time the sedan was anywhere nearby. The driver was probably one of the hotshot kids who worked for Slater, exercising his God-given teenage right to ignore common sense. Keeping the distance between themselves and the road at 100 feet at least, they hiked on a northern heading that should take them straight to the lodge. Any cameras would likely be concentrated on the road rather than scattered in the wilderness. But just to be safe, Ananka tasked Dylan with making periodic binocular sweeps on thermal setting, and Liesl doing the same with the electronics detection app. It took 8 minutes before they caught their first glimpse of the lodge. 3 stories and as wide as a city block. Light oozed out from several windows on the first and second floors, while on the third, only 2 were lit. Those glowing on the second floor were grouped together near the middle, and on the first, spread from end to end. 5 chimneys rose from the roof. Though it was too dark to see any smoke, one of the fireplaces must have been in use because Ananka could smell the burning wood. A well-manicured lawn fronted the building, creating a wide gap between the lodge and the woods. Off to the right, where the entrance road led out, was a dirt parking area containing several cars. Ananka examined the building through her binoculars. The open lawn area and the parking lot were illuminated by floodlights similar to those back at the gate. But unlike at the gate, an electronic scan revealed at least 6 devices, presumably cameras, attached to the lodge. Ananka opened the tracking map on her phone and used the information the administrator had given her to locate Ricky. The dot representing him sat squarely in the building, the dimensional call-out putting his vertical location 11 feet below ground level, in the basement. That jived with what Keller had told them. She led her team to the right and circled through the forest to the other side of the lodge. As the back came into view, she saw that here, too, a clear area separated the structure from the trees, only it was mainly dirt, not grass. What caught her attention was the van parked next to the building, its back doors open wide so she could see inside. She signaled the others to stop and raised her binoculars. The vehicle was the same make and model as the one she and Harris had hijacked, but it wasn't identical. It had a ramp leading from the back to the ground, and the 4 metal beds the other van contained were missing here. Instead, 4 people in wheelchairs occupied the space. The chairs appeared to be locked against the walls, 2 per side, facing the middle. Their occupants were all leaning forward, heads bowed. Unconscious, or close to it, she guessed. Ananka couldn't see any of the people's faces, but the small person in the chair on the left, farthest back, was the same size and had the same long dark hair as Rosario. After a closer look at the others, she held her glasses out to Harris. Before the cop could raise them, Ananka touched her hand. "Remember, you promised to do what I say and not act out on your own." Tensing, Harris began lifting the glasses, but once more Ananka stopped her. "Tell me you remember."
"I remember."
Ananka let go of her hand. "There are 4 people in the back of the van. I want you to look at the one on the right side, closest to us." Ananka knew the moment Harris located the correct passenger by the way the cop suddenly squeezed the binoculars. "It's Tasha, isn't it?" Ananka asked.
"Yes."
Harris packed more anger into a 3-letter word than Ananka thought possible. A faint hum emanated from the area behind the lodge. Ananka grabbed the binoculars from Harris and aimed them at the noise. Light shot out of the ground adjacent to the lodge, and a few moments later, 2 men rose into view, standing behind 2 more occupied wheelchairs. Ananka recognized 3 of the people.
The standing pair were Dalton Slater and his half-brother, Leo Yates. One of those sitting was Ricky. Ananka checked her tracker, just to confirm. Ricky's dot and his vertical location matched what she was seeing. Slater and Yates wheeled the chairs up the ramp into the van, where they anchored them with straps, one on each side. As they were doing this, two more men rose out of the hole. Young guys. More members of Slater's youth brigade. When Slater and Yates exited the van, the younger men removed the ramp and slipped it into a slot below the floor of the rear compartment. Then they hopped in back, and Slater and Yates closed them inside. The two older men walked to the front. When the brake lights flashed on, Ananka lowered the binoculars but kept her eyes on the van. Keller had told them the trials were held farther north within the forest that belonged to the lodge. If he hadn't lied, the truck would head in that direction instead of south, back toward the gate. The van slowed as it reached the far end of the lodge and turned left. North. She grinned. 30. 10:17 p.m. Built into the backside of a small crest, 50 yards from the clearing that served as the trial's starting point, was the concrete building containing the final holding cells for the prey. The front portion was essentially a long hallway-like room, from which there were entrances to 10 individual cells. The only ways in and out of the rooms were through thick steel-reinforced doors that had handles only on the outside. The highest number of cells ever used at one time had been 8, though plans were for 9 to be put to use for this session's final trial in 2 days, depending on the quality of product from the shipment due in that night. For the upcoming midnight trials, they were using 6 cells, starting from the right. Each of the prey had been laid out on army cots and were still unconscious. That would change in 1 hour and 28 minutes, when they would each be administered a jolt of adrenaline, and then at 12:03 a.m., paraded into the meadow and presented to the trial participants. Yates entered the building, shoving his phone back into his pocket. "Still on schedule?" Slater asked. "Yep," Yates replied. "Truck's about 2 hours south of Spokane, so unless they blow a tire, we're good." "Ready for a fence check?" "Let's do it." Using Ricky's tracking bug to guide them, Ananka and the others caught up with the van 30 minutes after it had left the lodge. More specifically, what they caught up to was a concrete building half buried in the side of the ridge. Ricky's dot glowed from inside the structure. The team hid among a rock outcropping about 75 yards away and surveyed the site. A door in the middle of the building was the only access point. Yates paced outside, near the door, talking on the phone, while the two young guys who'd ridden in the back of the van stood sentry with M4 rifles at opposite ends of the ridge above the building. The only other details of note were the 3 4x4 ATVs sitting next to the parked van.
"No cameras attached to the building," Liesl whispered.
"Nothing in the trees either," Dylan added.
Security here was undoubtedly a delicate situation. The last thing they'd want would be to have recordings of their activities end up in the wrong hands. Better not to have any at all. Besides, even if a prisoner escaped, he or she would make it only as far as the 15-foot-high electric fence. Probably not even that far, given what Keller had said about the tracking bugs they implanted in everyone. Poor Ricky. He must feel like a pincushion. Yates lowered his phone as he reached for the door. For 2 seconds, Ananka had a view inside, but all she could see was another wall not too far beyond the entrance and part of a door set in it. She lowered her binoculars and motioned for everyone to gather around.
"Keller said there's a clearing where the trial starts," she whispered. "It can't be far. Dylan, find it and learn everything you can about it. Liesl, I want you and Morgan to stay here and keep an eye on that building. If I'm right, nothing should happen until closer to midnight, but if I'm wrong, report right away. I'm going to scout out the area where this hunt is supposed to take place."
She checked the time.
"It's 10:18. We rendezvous back here in 1 hour. Questions?"
From back toward the building came the sound of the door opening, then a voice, followed by a laugh, and another voice, younger. Ananka, Liesl, Dylan, and Harris all brought up their binoculars. Slater and Yates had exited the building, and Slater was talking to one of the guards on the ridge. When he finished, Slater and his brother walked toward the van, but their destination turned out to be the ATVs. They each climbed onto one, started it up, and sped past the building into the forest. Ananka glanced over at Dylan.
"Try not to let them catch you."
"A little confidence, please," he said. "I'm not Ricky."
They headed off in opposite directions. Dylan thought the easiest way to find the meadow was to locate the path leading there from the building. There had to be a path, right? If the building was where they kept the victims, God, it made him sick every time he thought about it, then there had to be an easy way to take them to their deaths. Moving through the woods in an arc that never took him closer than 150 feet to the ridge, Dylan looked for the path. Not far past the 90-degree mark, he found it. While the ground wasn't so beaten down that grass and clover stopped growing on it, someone had cleared away the 6-foot-wide strip of trees and large bushes. Not knowing if any other of Slater's people were around, Dylan paralleled the path from a dozen feet inside the woods. It went basically straight for maybe 100 feet before it took a gentle dip into a depression. Another 50 feet on, he found the meadow. It was shaped almost like a baseball field, one end coming together at a sharp point, with the meadow flaring out wide until it was swallowed again by the forest about 100 yards away. Near the pointed end, a little farther than where a pitcher's mound would be, sat a platform that had ramps leading off it on all sides but one. Using the binoculars on thermal mode, Dylan scanned the clearing for human-sized heat signatures, but it was clear. He trained the lenses on the woods surrounding the clearing. He couldn't see through the trees, but could confirm no one was standing between them. Still not ready to step into the field, Dylan walked down to the rounded point. There, he found another trail, wide enough for a vehicle. He followed it away from the clearing. It was nowhere near as long as the one that had brought him here, as it ended after 50 feet at a wide dirt area, sprinkled with footprints and tire tracks. It didn't take a genius to figure out this was where the vehicles that brought the hunters parked. Dylan returned to the meadow and continued around the home plate end to the other side. In a nook within the trees, he found what he could only describe as a spectator area, 2 rows of benches, the back one set up on a mound of dirt so those sitting there could see over the heads of those in front. The idea of spectators here repulsed him even more. He searched through the woods all the way down the side and continued doing the same across the far end of the meadow and back down the side from where he originally arrived. Though he discovered no other man-made items, he did note several potential ambush spots and hiding places. Upon completing the search of the surrounding woods, he checked his watch and saw he had just enough time left for a closer examination of the meadow. At the beginning of her scout, Ananka used the sound of the ATVs to guide her, thinking Slater and Yates would be checking the grounds where the trial was to take place. This led her into a densely wooded area, north-northwest of the meadow Dylan was checking. What she really wished she had was a pair of night vision goggles. She'd have to talk to the administrator about including them in future missions. Future missions? Am I really considering that? Refocusing on the task at hand, she buried the thought. She may not have had night vision goggles, but her binoculars were equipped with an adequate night vision setting. The only problem was that she had to be farther away from her target than if she were using goggles, not to mention she'd need to raise the glasses whenever she wanted a more detailed look. A sweep through the trees ahead revealed several items of interest. She proceeded to the first, a pine tree about 30 feet away with an almost oval chunk of bark missing. She ran a hand over the spot and found the exposed wood splintered and ripped and riddled with dozens of tiny holes. She was tempted to shine a light into one of the holes, but the risk of exposure was not worth it. Besides, she knew a shotgun blast when she saw one. Moving on, she saw other trees had also been marred by firearms. She didn't want to imagine what might have happened here, but it was impossible not to. A captive running for his or her life? Some entitled asshole stalking him with a shotgun and a tracking device showing exactly where the prey was? A series of blasts as the hunter flushed the runner out of a hiding place. Then somewhere, probably not far from where Ananka was standing, the shot taking down the innocent, blood splattering the ground, a shout of triumph from the hunter, the prey either dead or reeling in pain. Perhaps there was a final shot to put the victim out of his misery. Or maybe the hunter and his colleague stood around and waited for the prisoner to take his last breath. Ananka's face hardened. She picked up her pace and squeezed out every second she had to scout the area before it was time to head back. At 11 o'clock on the dot, a 4-note musical alert repeated 3 times from speakers in the suites of all the participants. This was followed by the voice of Miss Riefenstahl.
"Good evening, gentlemen. I hope you have had a pleasant rest. In 20 minutes, please join me by the fireplace for some quick refreshments." All the participants were in the main room well ahead of time. The hostess entered at exactly 11:30, followed by 2 young men carrying trays of hors d'oeuvres. The men set the appetizers on a table next to the bar and began pouring flutes of champagne. As soon as they were done, Miss Riefenstahl grabbed one of the glasses.
Gentlemen, please. When they each had a flute, the hostess raised hers. May the coming trial provide challenge, excitement, and most of all, success. Everyone drank. Help yourselves, she said, gesturing to the appetizers. But I'd advise against eating too much. You won't want to be sluggish on the field. There will also be a full breakfast once the trial is finished. At first, no one approached the food, but soon, one by one, the men made their way to the trays, taking two or three of the treats before moving on. The hostess moved through the room, sharing a word of encouragement with each man and wishing them all good luck. At 11:35, a young man appeared briefly in the dining room doorway and gave her a subtle nod. The hostess returned to the front of the room. Gentlemen, it is time. If you would follow me, we will pick up your weapons and return to the carts. Dylan had returned by the time Ananka got back. Any change? She asked Liesl, glancing at the half-hidden building. Slater and Yates drove back about 10 minutes ago and went inside. That is about it. To Dylan, Ananka said, tell us about the meadow. After he described what he'd found, Ananka did the same about her recon and then laid out how she wanted to proceed. When she finished, Dylan grinned. I like the way you think, boss. You'll be okay with the rifle? Ananka asked Liesl. Of course. Ananka turned to Harris. Last chance for you to get out of this.
No thanks.
Then I guess it's time to get into position. They each grabbed the equipment they required and set out for their assigned spots.
31. 11:45 p.m. Ricky's eyelids shot open and he gasped for air. He tried to sit up, but quickly discovered he wasn't going anywhere. Straps across his chest, waist, and thighs held him down, while thinner ones secured his wrists and ankles. Deep breaths, a voice said. Ricky twisted his head toward the sound. Welcome back, Yates said, smiling. Ricky kept his expression as blank as possible. You're a tough one, aren't you? That's good. You might even be the last one standing. Yates leaned in and whispered, We could make it a little easier on you, you know? Make sure you don't suffer too much. All you have to do is tell us who you are and who you're working for. Ricky snorted. Your call, Yates said, but in about 20 minutes, you're really going to wish you talked. Ricky burst out laughing as if it were the funniest thing he'd ever heard. Rosario woke to find Slater standing over her, an empty syringe dangling from his hand. Every cell in her body tingled as if each had received an individual jolt of electricity. She glared at her captor, jaw tense.
Hola, chica, he said. You'll have to forgive me. That's about the extent of my hablo español. You speak English?
She didn't reply. Shrugging, he said,
Well, if you do, I'd advise you not to try to break free. It'd be a waste of energy you're going to wish you still had later. I've seen it happen before.
He turned for the door.
We'll be back in a bit.
Rosario watched him leave and then looked back at the ceiling. She didn't know what they had planned for her, but she wasn't going to sit back and let it happen. The off-road golf carts brought the participants back to the trial starting point, where the men were once more escorted onto the field. Lights mounted in the trees lit the clearing from one end to the other. Like that afternoon, Mr. Lean waited for them on the platform, only this time he held a long, cloth-covered object in his hands.
Good evening, gentlemen, Mr. Lean said. Welcome to the Midnight Trials. Some of our past guests consider this to be the most difficult and rewarding event on the schedule. I'll leave that for you to decide, though. Tonight, you will all take the field at the same time. 6 prey will be released. You are each allowed 1 kill. Once you've bagged your trophy, you will return here to await the others. As an added incentive, whoever takes down the one we have determined to be the most difficult target will receive this.
He removed the cloth, covering the item he was holding. Underneath was a gold-plated Mossberg shotgun mounted on a long black plaque. Though each participant was more than wealthy enough to commission hundreds of such prizes for himself, their eyes lit up at the sight of the prize. One of the assistants took the shotgun from Mr. Lean and carried it off the field.
You have each been assigned an observer, Mr. Lean continued. They are available to provide limited assistance. The actual tracking and eliminating of your prey will be up to you, of course.
As he spoke, 6 young men emerged from the woods and took spots behind the hunter they would be shadowing.
Are there any questions? Mr. Lane asked. No one spoke.
Excellent. Then let's get things started.
Raising his voice, he said,
Bring out the prey.
Rosario heard the rattle of metal beyond the door to her room. A lot of metal. When it stopped, the noise was replaced by footsteps and a door opening. Not hers, though. Silence for a minute, and then another door, and another. And then hers.
Time to play, Slater said as he entered.
Yates came in behind him, with a young guy who looked like another knockoff of the proto-adult she'd seen at the barn. The clone took a position halfway between the cot and the door, holding a Mossberg shotgun, while the two older men approached Rosario. They strapped a leather cuff around each of her legs just above the ankles. The restraints were connected to each other by a 2-foot length of chain. The men hooked up a similar rig to her wrists. The only difference between it and the one between her ankles was a 3-inch metal hoop at the chain's midpoint. Slater wrapped a final cuff around her neck. This, too, had a chain extending from it, only it wasn't connected to anything. After they removed the straps holding her to the bed, Slater yanked on the throat cuff chain.
Get up.
Rosario rose to her feet. This way, Slater said, giving her another tug. He and Yates led her out of the room into a long hallway where another one of the young clones was standing watch over three people who, like Rosario, were in cuffs and chains. Yates hurried ahead and grabbed the end of a long chain off the floor. The other prisoners were already attached to it, so it was no surprise that Yates threaded the chain through the hoop between her wrist cuffs and clipped them together once she was 3 feet behind the nearest other captive.
Stay, Slater ordered.
He and Yates and the kid with the Mossberg disappeared inside the cell next to Rosario's, emerging a minute later with Tasha Patterson in tow. The chain was played through the woman's hoop, and she was clipped in place behind Rosario. When the asshole brothers and their minion entered another room, Rosario snuck a peek at the guard who'd been left behind. He scanned the lot of them back and forth, his gaze never stopping. When his eyes had moved off her, she chanced a very low,
Tasha,
over her shoulder. The woman continued to stare at the ground, apparently not having heard her. Rosario was about to say her name again when a shout came from the room Slater and Yates were in. The hallway guard rushed to the door and looked inside. Rosario turned and whispered more loudly,
Tasha! Tasha Patterson!
Patterson blinked at Rosario.
We're here to get you out, but you need to stay strong and alert.
Patterson said,
Get me out? Yes. Whatever happens, stay close to me.
I don't know you, do I?
No. We are friends of Scott Davos.
That got through.
Scott? He asked us to find you.
Confusion again. Who is us?
Another roar from inside the room, followed by a body staggering out and smashing against the wall. Ricky turned and faced the way he'd just come, smiling.
That was good. You're pretty strong, you...
The chain attached to his neck cuff jerked forward, yanking Ricky to the ground.
That is us, Rosario said.
On the list of things Ricky did not like, being restrained was right there near the top. His anger had been building since he woke, and had skyrocketed when the cuffs and chains were put on him. But Ricky waited, holding on to that fire. When Slater tugged on the leash and told Ricky to get up, Ricky did. Only instead of stopping once he was on his feet, he launched himself at Yates, aiming to headbutt him in the nose. But Yates turned his face away a second before contact, taking the brunt of Ricky's thick skull in the cheek. The shout of pain Yates let out was glorious, and Ricky would have sworn on a stack of Bibles he'd heard the guy's cheekbone crack. Slater pulled the chain again to get Ricky away from his brother, which was exactly what Ricky was expecting. He went with it, using the momentum to swing over toward the punk with the shotgun. He came within inches of getting his hands on the weapon before Slater rushed over and shoved Ricky to the side, sending him shooting out into a hallway. Ricky twisted back around and grinned at Slater.
That was good. You're pretty strong, you...
Slater tugged on the chain again. One second Ricky was standing, the next he was on the floor. Hands grabbed his arms and hauled him back to his feet. Slater and the clone marched Ricky over to where several other cuffed people were standing in a line. When Ricky saw Rosario 2 places in front of him, he was relieved. He'd been wondering what had happened to her after the gas. He winked at her, and she gave him the tiniest of smirks. She then flicked her gaze at the woman standing between them.
Tasha Patterson, how about that? Looks like we wrapped this case up.
He laughed, earning him a hard shove in the back.
What?
He said.
You got something against good moods?
Slater grabbed the shotgun from the kid. I'll tell you what. He walked past Ricky and Patterson to Rosario and stuck the double barrel under her chin. Any more trouble out of you and your friend pays for it.